This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Physics is one of the oldest branches of science, one in which a unified theory of the universe is the goal, and precise data and rigorous analyses are the standard. Biology, on the other hand, is one of the youngest branches of science, one with few grand theories, but a growing abundance of data. And there's a long history of physicists jumping into the biology realm when there's a sense that major breakthroughs could be made. Nigel Goldenfeld holds a Swanland Endowed Chair and is a Center for Advanced Study professor in physics at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. But much of his recent research focuses on the evolution of life. I spoke with him during a recent visit to Woods Hole. Nigel Goldenfeld, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you very much for having me.
During your brief visit, just a few days in Woods Hole, you're giving two lectures, one of which is about laminar turbulent transitions. I looked the phrase up. Basically, my understanding, it's when a fluid goes from flowing in a kind of nice, straight, orderly pattern to flowing in a really swirling, chaotic pattern. What is so interesting about that transition for you?
So the way you describe the transition is absolutely accurate. In fact, now I don't need to give my talk.
If only that were true.
But, people have been studying that for about 130 years. So the first person who scientifically studied this was Osborne Reynolds in the 1880s. And he noticed that when a fluid becomes turbulent in a pipe, it didn't just sort of all be laminar, or be just going straight and then all being chaotic and turbulent. And it did it in little bursts and little patches. And as you cranked up the speed of the fluid, those patches got bigger or they lasted longer. And people have, in the last 10 years or so, really tried to use modern techniques to study this in great detail. And they've discovered very surprising phenomena that as you crank up the speed, the little patches of turbulence start lasting longer and longer and longer, and their lifetime increases in a very strange mathematical way, and then they start to split and they propagate outwards, and then they eventually fill the pipe with turbulence. So the actual, you know, you look at the patterns in space and in time of how fluids become turbulent, it's not simple at all. And why I'm interested in it is I'm interested in phase transitions, how materials change state, say from ice to water, or from being a metal to an insulator or something like this. And so I was interested in studying this problem as a problem in statistical physics and a problem in phase transitions.
135-odd years of studying this problem, and we still don't have an explanation. I mean, it's clearly not as simple as there's a piece of sand in the pipe that causes it to get off track and go turbulent or something like that. We still can't explain why.
There is things like that, but people want to understand the systematics and understand that in great detail. Exactly how does the lifetime of little turbulent patches increase as you crank up the speed? And it does it in a very strange way, in a way that's unlike any other problem that I know of in physics. And so that's what got people very excited. And the other thing is, you know, turbulence is the, if you like, the last great unsolved problem of classical physics. You know, nobody thinks you need quantum mechanics to understand turbulence, but we all know about turbulence. We all experience it when we are in aeroplanes or something like this, and we don't really have a fundamental understanding of it. And so maybe if we can understand something about how the transition from laminar to turbulence occurs, maybe that would help us understand a bit more about turbulence.
Are there real-world problems like boats moving through the water or airplanes flying that would be helped in some way by understanding turbulence at this level? Or is this just an academic desire to understand how the world works?
No, I think if you want to flow, say, oil through a pipe or gas through a pipe, something like this, you have to worry about these sorts of flow phenomena. So we use pipes all the time. If you want to understand how your blood flows through the blood vessels in your body, in some cases there's some parts of your body where you can actually have turbulent flow. And so you have to understand these things in practical situations. But what was the big surprise for us was in studying this problem, it turned out to end up being mathematically very similar to other problems I was interested in, but in biology. And so,
like what?
Well, it turned out to be very similar to what happens if I have an ecosystem where I have a predator and a prey, like a wolf eating sheep. And it turns out that the behavior of that system, the wolf and sheep system, is very similar mathematically to what happens at the onset of turbulence.
Okay, explain that a little bit more. How are those mathematically similar?
So here's the thing. If you have, so let me just tell you what happens in an ecosystem. So you have a predator like the wolf eating the sheep. And so they eat the sheep and then the sheep population goes down. Now the wolf population doesn't have enough food to eat. So the
wolf population goes down.
They go down. And then, of course, now there's not too many wolves around, so the sheep population can start to rise. And now when the sheep population starts to rise, well, then the wolf population can start to rise as well. And so you get this cycle of oscillations in the population. And we've learned in the last few years, again, this wasn't known maybe even 10 years or so ago, that these processes are very, very sensitive to the population size, and the population size governs how these fluctuating populations and cycles proceed. It's not like a simple sine wave, a simple deterministic oscillation like you might have in a pendulum in a grandfather clock or something like that. They're very noisy, and they're noisy in a very interesting mathematical way. And here's the thing that happens. If you have too few prey in the system, the predators will starve and the ecosystem will collapse. And how the ecosystem undergoes collapse, where there's, you know, the prey have basically gone extinct, that transition is mathematically like the turbulence transition.
I'm still trying to wrap my mind around this. So I guess the less prey, fewer prey, fewer predators, that oscillation would be maybe the equivalent of the laminar flow, that it seems like a neat...
No, that's actually... No, what we discovered was that if you look at the flow in the pipe near the onset of the turbulence transition, the fluid actually has a weird kind of collective behavior, that's not something sort of... It's something that emerges right out of the fluid flow. And this collective mode is kind of like a sort of vortex, interacts with the turbulence, sucks energy out of the turbulence. And it does it in the same way that predators kill sheep out of a population. So mathematically, they turn out, you have something that behaves like a wolf, and the turbulence behaves like the sheep. And the mathematics, it's you know, you see these modes in your computer simulations, and I hope we'll be able to see them in experiments. But they definitely are there, and we discover that they govern how fluids become turbulent. And it's not just fluids; it also happens in plasmas. You know, people who are trying to understand how to make fusion reactors have to worry about the turbulence and trying to suppress the turbulence. And these modes also happen in tokamaks in plasmas. So these things are, it's really quite a general phenomenon, or it seems like it might be. And so it's very curious because it applies in many different areas, and it has this weird connection between physics and some biology problems that I also happen to work on.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with physicist Nigel Goldenfeld of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. The other talk that you're giving while you're in Woods Hole is in the biology realm.
Yes.
Talking about not sheep and wolves, but about the evolution of early life. What's the connection there? I mean, I'm assuming this is not necessarily another same mathematics example of turbulence. So what's the connection then between things like turbulent flow and early evolution of life?
So there is a connection. So I would identify myself as primarily a condensed matter physicist.
So, and what is condensed matter?
Exactly. Nobody's ever heard of condensed matter. But if you look at the computer in your pocket, your iPhone or Google phone or something like this, all the electronics and so on is all run by, you know, semiconductor physics and solid state physics. That's all part of condensed matter physics, studying systems where the parts interact with each other in very complex ways to produce some interesting outcome. And so that's what my background is. And when I became interested in biology, I was naturally gravitating towards problems which resembled the problems in condensed matter physics, where the interactions between objects are much more powerful than the behavior of the individual objects themselves. So if you've got an ecosystem, it doesn't really matter too much what the predator is or the prey or many of the other things in it. All it matters is that they interact in some way where one eats the other or something like this. The actual details don't matter. And the collective phenomena that come out are arising from the how everything interacts with each other, rather than just one individual thing. So it's kind of like a network, where you have a network, and it doesn't really matter what the nodes of the network are, but the links are the things that are the important things. So when you look at early life, it turns out that early life did not behave in the same way that life does today. Life today has individual organisms, and it has individual species, individual lineages. What we discovered is that early life, prior to about 3.8 billion years ago, was not like that. It was completely connected. You had no notion of individuality, no notion of species, maybe even no notion of genes. Life was a very different kind of thing, and everything was sort of all smushed together in some strongly interacting soup, and from the properties of that, we can understand something that's very profound and useful today, and that is the genetic code. So we use the structure of the genetic code to try to understand something about early life. So the connection is basically, I'm looking for scientific problems where they're collective phenomena. They're not individuals acting on their own, but things that interact with each other to form collectives.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest is Nigel Goldenfeld of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. We'll talk more after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest is Nigel Goldenfeld of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He's a physicist, but much of his recent work is investigating the origins and evolution of life. You have described biology, the field of biology, as, and I'm quoting here, flooded by data but starved of fundamental insight. What do you mean by that?
Pretty much what I said. I mean, we are certainly collecting huge amounts of data in a way that's not driven by theory. Unlike in physical systems, where when you collect data, you usually have a some sort of theory that you're trying to test. In biology, we don't have a tradition of strong predictive theories. And so you basically have to collect data and then hope that some pattern emerges from it. And there really isn't. It's not that like physics, where there's some simple underlying principles and then you can test things like that. So we don't have, in many cases, fundamental understanding of the what's going on in the data sets that we're looking at. I work in genomics, for example, and we collect data, we sequence genomes, we look at genes, we look at jumping genes, we look at mobile genetic elements. We don't have any fundamental ideas which we can test quantitatively with the data that we collect, at least not now.
Could the theory of evolution be one fundamental principle like that, equivalent to some of the principles of physics?
Yeah, it is. The theory of evolution clearly is it's the theory of biology. I mean, people always say biology is full of exceptions, but there's no exception to evolution. So it is the underlying framework. But saying that and then being able to say, okay, can you predict for me, why 45% of the human genome is jumping genes, transposable elements? Well, we have no understanding of that, and we don't even know really what those transposable elements do, whether they're junk DNA or whether they are useful. So we have huge, huge gaps in our knowledge. It's not like it's different from physics, and I think it's important to emphasize that, because a lot of physicists do go into biology thinking it's going to be, just a special case and simpler than physics and so on. And it's not like that at all. It's a very different type of science, one that's much more actually challenging and in many ways more exciting.
Chaos and randomness are a really fundamental part of evolution and natural selection. Obviously, there's plenty of chaos in physical sciences as well, but do you think that there's a fundamentally different role that it plays that makes it less possible to be predictive about the outcomes of biology than perhaps of physics, and to come up with those really fundamental theories?
No, I don't think the randomness is the problem. I think the problem is our imaginations. We haven't really come up with good ways to write down models that are interesting of biological systems, and we also haven't found, in general, good questions to ask that are scientific questions, where we can then make a well-defined theory and test it in a quantitative way. But people are starting to do that. I mean, in the last 10 years, quantitative biology has become a huge growth area. There's a lot of physicists, mathematicians, computer people who've sort of started being interested in biology. And I think it's a very healthy trend because you need both a traditional, more qualitative biological perspective as well as the more quantitative one. And so there's pockets of optimism, I suppose, you could say, where we will start to have a predictive theory, a predictive science.
I mean, as you say, there is a history of physicists moving into biology, attempting to seek those fundamental insights, those really guiding principles, but they're very different fields. Is there a danger of perhaps going the wrong direction or coming at things the wrong way when you take a physicist's worldview and way of approaching scientific problems and simply try to apply those to biology?
Yeah, I think you have to recognize that the reason that physics is so successful is because it works on very, very simple problems. And most physicists don't recognize that.
I don't think most of us recognize that. Most physics doesn't seem incredibly simple.
Oh, it's breathtakingly simple. The calculations you have to do to work out the consequences of things are very complicated, but fundamentally they're very simple situations. Biology is much, much more complicated, and that's why it's much harder to make progress in. So the illusion that we are physicists have done so much because, you know, they're so great and so on, I think that's completely wrong. It's just that we would choose to work on very easy problems. But let me give you an example of how the interface between biology and physics can be extremely successful. So perhaps my favorite example is something called the Luria-Delbruck experiment, which was done in the 1940s. So this was the idea was to understand the basic premise of the theory of evolution, which is that you have pre-existing mutations in a population, and then those are selected by some environmental pressure, say starvation or temperature or whatever it is, and the mutants that happen to be well-suited to the change in the environment, they breed more, and so you get more of them, and so that's how the population evolves. And that idea is the basis of natural selection. But an alternative idea is that when you change the environment, the population creates new mutations deliberately to thrive in that environment. So those are two opposite things, and who knows which is correct? So the way it was resolved, or at least resolved at the current level of understanding, was done by a very ingenious experiment where people, Luria and Delbruck, looked at bacteria populations, and they exposed them to viruses, and the viruses would kill the bacteria, and they would try to find bacteria that could have immunity to the viruses. And what they worked out mathematically was that if the standard natural selection idea was correct, there was existing variation, some mutants already existing in the population that were immune to the viruses, then you would see large fluctuations in the number of colonies that would survive this type of selection pressure, this exposure to the viruses. But if it was done by some adaptation to the viruses, the second idea, where the mutations happen in such a way as to thrive in that bad environment, then you would have much smaller fluctuations in the number of colonies that you would get in your experiment.
Why? So if there are underlying mutations already there, the number of those would vary from population to population?
What would happen is this. If you, the easiest thing to consider is, let's suppose the mutations arose in response to adding the viruses. So you grow your bacterial colonies and then you expose them to a virus. Well, then what's going to happen is they're going to suddenly adapt to the viruses, mutate, and you're going to find a certain number of them will survive because they've mutated. And it'll always be the same each time you do it because, you know, it's more or less reproducible. If, on the other hand, it's pre-existing, then sometimes it might happen that the mutant arose maybe 10 generations before, and so now there's many, many of the mutants in the population. Sometimes it might happen that the mutant arose by chance 3 generations before you exposed it to the phage. And so in that case, there's going to be many fewer daughter copies of the cells that have the mutation that enables them to survive. And the mathematics of that predicts exactly what you would see. And when they did the experiment, it was pretty much consistent with the large fluctuation idea, which means natural selection, as we sort of understand it, seems to be correct.
That's clearly an example of how you could answer that question using maybe a physicist's worldview,
right,
but using a mathematical approach to
right,
the problem. Is that not something that we could have answered using a more purely biological approach, sequencing DNA along the way or something of that sort? Did it have to be answered in that mathematical way?
I don't know, but I know that Delbruck was a physicist and Luria was a biologist, and Delbruck started thinking about phages when he started becoming a biologist. They won the Nobel Prize for work, which presumably included this work. You know, this is how it was done. It's just a historical fact. If it hadn't been done, who knows what would have happened? But it's a really great example of how having the perspective of a physicist could, you know, and a physicist who's prepared to understand the biology, which is a very important point, how putting the two together, you can do something that neither one would have been able to do on their own. And I think it's a wonderful example.
You mentioned earlier that early life looked nothing like modern life.
Yes.
Can you give us more of a picture, a mental image of what we think early life did look like?
Right. So the reason why I say that is this. Let's suppose that you think about where your genes are going. Okay, so your genes are going to your children, and your children will transmit their genes to their children, and so on and so forth. You certainly don't think that any of my genes are coming to you, right? You know, I could pop out some DNA, send it over to you, and suddenly you'd know how to do physics.
That would be pretty surprising.
That'd be pretty surprising. But actually it happens.
Really?
Yes, it really happens. It happens in bacteria and archaea. We know that for sure. And that's been known for about 50 years. What we hadn't known until about 5 years or so ago was that it actually can happen in multicellular eukaryotes. And we now know it happens between bacteria and fruit flies and lizards and tetrapods and mammals. So we know that it does happen at some lower level. People hadn't really considered that possibility. Now, it may not be a big effect going on right now between us, but early life, that effect was a dominant effect. In other words, giving your genes to your children and having a family tree of life is now how we think of life. But early on, before about 3.8 billion years ago, what we believe is that it wasn't like that at all, that the transfer of genes, if you like, horizontally rather than vertically, vertically being to your children, horizontally meaning to people, to organisms you're not related to, that horizontal transfer was more dominant. And what that means is that there's no such thing as a species. And there's no such thing as a family tree, an individual organismal lineage. It means that you have communities that are changing in time, varying in descent, but not individual organismal lineages. So this massive horizontal gene transfer is important. Now, why is it important? It speeds up the rate of evolution. If I'm transferring genes willy-nilly, then evolution goes much faster.
Doesn't it fundamentally change the mechanism of evolution?
It does. You still have natural selection. You're still, if you can make more copies of yourself than somebody else, you're going to have greater reproductive success. But it does change the dynamics of evolution, and it makes it much, much faster. And that's how life was able to start from nothing sometime after the Earth started 4.6 billion years ago. And by 3.8 billion years, we already had in existence modern cells with their ability to translate and transcribe and replicate, much like modern cells today do. So the cells 3.8 billion years ago, less than a billion years after the start of the planet Earth, were already recognizably the same architecture as our modern cells. So how do you go from nothing to something so complex so quickly? So that's been a big mystery for a long time, and what we believe is that the rapidity of evolution that happens when you have horizontal gene transfer, this collective effect, is responsible for that. It's also responsible, by the way, for the fact that we are running out of antibiotics. So today, as you probably know, antibiotics are losing their efficacy. And you could introduce a new antibiotic 5 years later, the bacteria start to become immune to it on a global basis. And how does that happen? Well, they are busy exchanging their genes in your guts right now and in hospital in hospitals and surfaces and whatever environment you meet the bacteria in.
That mode of evolution hasn't disappeared.
It's just
not perhaps the dominant one at this point.
Well, it's dominant for things like antibiotic resistance genes. It's not dominant for things like genes that code for the translational machinery of the cell.
How do we know? How do we look back at what was happening 3.8 billion years ago? Physicists have the benefit of looking at distant galaxies and stars and almost literally looking back in time. Do we have any equivalent technique in biology to be able to look back, or is what we're working with some pretty sophisticated guesswork about what was going on 3.8 billion years ago?
No, we do have the ability to look back. So the way we can look back to about 3.8 billion years is by looking at DNA, and if you compare the DNA for parts of the cell that should be very fundamental and really shouldn't change very much. Like, we all have to translate DNA into, or messenger RNA into proteins. That's how we're built. You make proteins from the code the sequence that's encoded in messenger RNA. So that's called translation. And the machine that does that is a very ancient and very powerful fundamental machine called the ribosome. And we know that if you look at that machine, it really can't change that much. If it doesn't work, you're dead. So basically every cell has that in it. And by looking at parts of that machine, we can see how it works. And in particular, we can look at the genes that code for that and see how they vary between organisms. They don't vary very much, but they vary a little bit over evolutionary time. And so from that, we can sort of infer the history of its evolution. We can see that this organism must have come before this one must have come after that one, and we can put the pieces together and get a jigsaw map of the history of life. And that was actually first done by my colleague Carl Woese and George Fox at the University of Illinois in 1977. Now, how do you look further back than 3.8 billion
years?
That's
what I was about to ask you. Right. Can we even do that?
Well, we can. And the reason is this. When you look at the genetic code, now that people always think of the genetic code as being the sequence of nucleotides in your genome, but that's not what the genetic code is. The genetic code is how the ribosome reads that sequence and turns it into proteins. It literally has a code book. All the complicated biochemistry that's going on can get decoded, where you read nucleotide bases, A's, C's, and G's, and T's, and things, in groups of three, and figure out how those groups of three bases translate into a particular amino acid.
So, and then those are the building blocks that string those all together, and you get the proteins that
right.
So they make a cell work.
Right. So your proteins are made from amino acids, and how do you know which amino acid to put in the protein? You look at the messenger RNA sequence that has come from your DNA, and that tells you what amino acids you need. And that code that tells you how you go from the messenger RNA to the proteins, that code isn't some random thing. It has mathematical structure. And that's the big clue. How could that mathematical structure arise? Now, the mathematical structure is pretty easy to explain. What it is this. You could imagine that I've got a code table, and it says, what amino acid do I need at this place in the protein? And it's some particular amino acid, let's say. Well, let's suppose there's been a mutation, or the machinery goes wrong. And instead of having the correct amino acid, you get the wrong one. Okay? If that amino acid is very completely different chemically from the amino acid you should have got, then your protein will be completely messed up and it won't work. So what the genetic code that we have is, remarkably, the genetic code that is least sensitive to that. In other words, it's a genetic code which is...
It's the hardest one to make a mistake. Is that right?
It's the one where if you make a mistake, that mistake is going to be the least problematic of any code that you could get. If you're going to get an amino acid that you should have got and you don't get that, you get a different amino acid, that amino acid will be very, very close to the one that you should have got. Okay? So that's not an accident. There's no
way. So instead of getting, you're making a recipe and you make a mistake, and instead of grabbing the sugar, you grab
salt.
The brown sugar.
Right. That's right. You could grab sugar in it, or you could get salt. That would be terrible. That would not go well. If you get sugar and you put in brown sugar, that probably won't make any difference. So that's how the genetic code has been constructed. We know that it has that characteristic, and we can we can test how well it has that characteristic, and by various computer simulation techniques, and it's the probability of that happening by chance is like one part in 100 million.
Let's circle back to where we started with this. We have a genetic code, and that code can evolve. How does that help us understand how life arose and what took place in that period of getting from no life to cells that look very much like modern cells?
It doesn't really tell us how life started, but it does tell us that early life had to have been this process, which I described before. And if you want a physical picture of what it looks like, I would say what you should think about is endosymbiosis, which is a fancy word for saying that the cells are very transparent to each other, and they can merge with each other and form some globule and then come out again. And in doing that, they swap bits and pieces of themselves. So if you want to think of early life, think of it as being some blobby things that are constantly, you know, sucking each other up and eating each other and swapping pieces around and so on. Very porous organisms. So they couldn't have been very... early life certainly didn't work very well. I mean, you know, think about early automobiles. Early automobiles were, you know, rickety old things. Their top speed was 10 miles an hour and bits fell off them all the time and stuff like this. And you compare them to modern cars, they're nothing like that at all. They're much more efficient. So early life was probably like that too. And one of the things in particular that they seem to have been able to do was to merge with each other. And so there was this no notion of individuality. There was a lot of collective effect. And that's probably, that's my guess. It's not a scientifically based guess, but that's my guess about what was actually going on in those days.
Nigel Goldenfeld, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Nigel Goldenfeld holds a Swanland Endowed Chair and is a Center for Advanced Study professor in physics at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He spoke with Living Lab during a recent visit to Woods Hole. And that's our show for today. Until next week, this is Living Lab on The Point. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on The Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support from Michael and Roxanne Zach. Living Lab is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.